This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, March 30th, 2012. I'm Caleb Brown. It was a rare week at the Supreme Court to assess the president's health care law. First, the court had to decide if they could rule on some matters at all. Then they parsed the individual mandate, and then they considered the law's dramatic expansion of Medicaid. Trevor Burrus, a legal associate at the Cato Institute, takes a look at what happened and what's next. Weather forecasters have to do live shots outside of a building or out in the snow, for example. They will stick a ruler into the snow to measure the inches of precipitation. That is not how you measure inches of precipitation, of course, and they know that. And I think a lot of reporters who cover the Supreme Court, TV reporters especially, know better than to draw too many conclusions from an oral argument at the Supreme Court. In this case, we're talking about a highly contentious issue, an issue where pretty much only a couple of votes seem to matter. Is it fair to read this much into the oral argument that occurred at the Supreme Court this week?
Well, it depends on what side of the issue you're on. I think that the opponents of the mandate have much more to read into the argument than the proponents of the mandate. And how much the proponents of the mandate, the people who think it's constitutional, particularly the scholars and media types, how much the proponents of the mandate have sort of gone off on the oral arguments to various degrees has been fascinating. But going into it, we didn't really know what would happen as an opponent of the mandate. We didn't know what arguments they were buying, whether or not they were understanding it. We've been working to make these distinctions and to make very, very fine arguments that explain exactly why the Constitution does not authorize this. And it was very heartening to see the court understand those and almost recite them back to us. The proponents were just astounded that they even understood the arguments, which for many, many months now it seems like they haven't been able to understand.
On the other side of that though, broadly speaking, Mr. Verrilli, who was the Solicitor General presenting that argument, had to have some help, I guess, from other justices articulating the argument that he was trying to make. Well, aren't they understanding of the arguments that he was trying to make quite well?
I think the justices, the liberal justices who were helping out the Solicitor General, there wasn't a lot of assistance there, and there's been a lot of criticism of the Solicitor General and his performance. And some of it's been a little extreme. I was a little surprised at how unprepared he actually was, particularly for questions like what is your limiting principle, which as opposed to saying something succinctly and shortly, it sounded like he could have recited any single page from the Federal Register as his little small limiting principle. But Justice Breyer in particular came to the assistance of the Solicitor General many times, sometimes erroneously. One of my favorite moments of Justice Breyer, who often assists the government in making his case. He sometimes doesn't seem like he's necessarily a justice as much as a secretary of law who's going to be here and tell you about what the law is. And he starts talking about McCulloch versus Maryland and very quick, didn't we create a bank and McCulloch allowed that to happen? And Paul Clement said, that's a different clause, Justice. That's not actually what we're talking about. So yes, there was assistance, and I think that maybe they understood the arguments. I'm not sure they care, to be honest. I don't think that the liberal justices are too concerned with affirmative limits on Congress's power. That is, limits about what Congress may do. I think that the liberals in this country, and this is just an observation, I think they're more concerned with negative limits on Congress's power, like the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment. And so it kind of seemed like they didn't really care.
In talking with Tim Sandifer, who co-authored one of the briefs with you on the Medicaid issue and trying to draw some sort of limit, made it clear that, well, look, the Supreme Court has never dealt with something this directly before. That is perhaps the weakest part of the case for opponents of the individual mandate, for opponents of Obamacare more largely, is asking the court to draw a line somewhere and make it clear that this is over this line, you do not pass. Do you have any sense of how that line could be drawn?
I think in the Medicaid expansion, which to remind our listeners, dealt with a grant of money to the states, and the federal government gives money to the states all the time and asks them to do things in set up programs and do things if they want to get this money, and the states do it a lot. Well, in part of Obamacare, asks states to expand their Medicaid coverage and says you don't have to participate in this, but if you don't, the secretary may take away all of your Medicaid funding, all of it, all 45 years of Medicaid funding. And so one of the questions about where was the – is that's coercion, because there's an idea that at some point the federal government is coercing people. And the line arguments are interesting, and this has been talked about for many, many decades. Can we draw a line? And it's one of these things where we don't want to draw a ridiculous line, like where we say, well, the line is 10%. That would be too specific. But we also don't want there to not be a line, or many people think that there should be a line. I think that the argument offered by Paul Clement, which gave three characteristics of why this one, this program, he's not even going to talk about other ones, doesn't work. And it included the individual mandate, because the individual mandate affects that Medicaid expansion. And so I think that those three principles give it a pretty discrete situation. I am not optimistic that the court is going to agree with him on that, but I think there'll be a lot of opinions that try to rearticulate or explain a test or a concept in coercive federal spending that hasn't been very well flushed out, which is actually why I think they took the question.
But in order for them to draw a line, they have to draw a line that says part of what we've done here is inappropriate, right? They can't draw a line that's beyond the scope of the question that's being put to them.
They can't draw lines beyond the scope, but they want to make a rule that can articulate something for future instances. So they have to look at the case in front of them and see if they can abstract principles from that case. So they could say, a ruling could say something like, in the event that the federal government conditions a new spending program on the possible elimination of an important, popular, and long-standing program run by the states. I mean, that's not a very off the top of my head, it's not a very good legal test, but that's what kind of thing a legal test would look like going forward. But they would try to limit it because they could write a test that would strike down many, many programs that are very popular.
We expect a decision quite possibly toward the end of June, though there's no requirement that it occur at that time. What's going on right now?
That's an interesting question. It is pretty much a sure bet that there will be a decision by the end of June, probably June 28th. Very rarely does the court not decide a case before that, before the term ends. They want to get everything done with a term and then move on to the next one. But they're not required to, as you pointed out. And if that went over the next term, it would be another example of something unprecedented that happened in this case. What's going on right now is Friday, the justices met to do their preliminary voting on what they think the outcome is in each of these cases. And with the four questions all together, there's a lot of possible interactions of how, for example, the Anti-Injunction Act, which was whether or not they could even hear the suit. If one justice thinks that that applies, then how do they deal with the question about actually hearing the merits when they don't think they should be hearing the merits of the suit? And there's all different types of things that go together. So they take a vote. The way it works generally is if the chief justice is in the majority of the vote, he assigns a decision and who will write the decision. Some people think, and I don't think unjustifiably, that if, for example, Chief Justice Roberts would like to strike down the mandate, if he is, let's say, in the five, let's say they voted today and five conservatives all voted to strike down the mandate, he will assign the opinion to himself to write a narrow and very, very clear opinion that explains why they're doing this and to address criticisms of them being, conservative and partisan, and because he wants to take that on himself because, it's his court at the end of the day when people in history say it's the Roberts court. And I think that's very likely. I'm 50-50, but I think if we strike down the mandate, opinion will come from Chief Justice Roberts. And after that, there's going to be a lot of opinion writing and passing them back and forth and seeing who if some justice is on the edge and they might agree to something that would be a little bit different, they pass opinions back and forth. at the end of the day, it's going to be a long and really, really complex opinion that I may run to 500 pages. We'll see.
Trevor Burrus is a legal associate at the Cato Institute. You can read our legal briefs and other writings on the Obamacare case at our website, cato.org.